Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, May 12th. We talk more about the R word, R for recession, amid news of a deal with China, why local economists aren't changing their forecast. The latest economic outlook casts more shade as lawmakers look to a possible special session to deal with the fallout from the nation's capital over impending budget cuts. We hear from the Senate President and House Speaker. Some in the community are asking, why aren't there more judges of Filipino descent being named to the bench? And the view from the pew. Surprise, surprise, a Chicago-born pope. What to make of the unexpected choice? Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Stocks surged this morning after officials from the U.S. and China announced a 90-day pause on tariffs while trade negotiations continue. But here in Hawaii, economists say the damage has already been done. A new report released Friday from the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization, UHERO, forecasts a mild recession for this year and next. It's an abrupt shift from the organization's last forecast and is due to President Donald Trump's tariff policy. Stephen Bond-Smith is an assistant professor at UHERO and one of the authors of the new forecast. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about local impacts of ongoing tariff uncertainty and what a mild recession will mean for Hawaii.
The last two recessions that people are aware of were obviously much more devastating. The downturn in 2008 was the biggest recession we'd seen in a very long time. And what we're seeing now is much milder than that. It's simply that Hawaii's economy has returned to sort of its long-run growth rate, which is relatively low anyway. But we expect that a slowdown in the U.S. and a slowdown in visitor numbers will then tip us just into negative territory. So technically, it becomes a recession, but it's much more mild than any recent recession.
In this report, you compare it to your last forecast and talk about the factors that have changed. It must be very difficult to make predictions at a time when so much is changing at the federal policy level.
Yeah, so the fall in our forecast relates to primarily to the tariffs, that the tariffs were so much higher than anyone was expecting, than what we were expecting last quarter when we made our last forecast. But the uncertainty compounds that. So when there's this uncertainty, businesses or consumers, they might just hold back, right? Because tariffs would be really high this month, but who knows what they're going to be next month or in 5 months' time. Or if you're a business and you're investing in expansion, you're looking at how much is it going to be in 5 years' time. So in order to, you know, make those decisions with better information, that uncertainty also means that people hold back, and that has economic effects. That means there's a slowdown as well.
Yeah. And let's talk about a metric like tourism, which is central to Hawaii's economy. It was surprising to me to see that international travel from both Japan and Canada were down. I'm looking at the report now, double-digit percentage declines in airlift from Japan and Canada. What are the reasons or some of the proposed reasons for why we're seeing that decline from those two countries specifically?
So both Canada and Japan, they're our two main largest international markets. And actually recently, Japan hasn't fully recovered from the pandemic. So actually, Canada is an even more important market now for Hawaii, relatively speaking. And visitor numbers from Canada are down. This is predominantly important for Oahu. So Oahu gets most of the international tourists. But visitors from Canada also particularly like visiting Maui. So it's a very large share of Maui, much more so than the other neighbor islands. Canada in particular is very integrated with the U.S. economy. And so when the U.S. puts tariffs on imports from Canada, that's going to really hurt their economy, and that's going to hurt their ability to spend money. And in general, they're saying this is a similar effect in the U.S., that it affects business, creates an economic slowdown that means that people are less able to afford that vacation, and that might be the thing that gets cut from their budget. But then in addition, with Canada, there's this geopolitical effect, right? That there's this sort of bad feeling about visiting the U.S. And that puts off a lot of visitors too. So that's going to compound that slowdown. With Japan, the slowdown is a bit smaller, but it's also coming from a much lower base than we're really used to. There's a lot of recovery that didn't happen there. And the fact that it's even more than the decline that's important here is the slowdown in that international recovery from Japan.
Let's talk about tariff effects on imports. And you made a point that I think is a good one to remind listeners that when we talk about imports to Hawaii, we're not in many cases talking about international imports. We're actually talking domestic imports that aren't affected by tariffs.
Yeah, that's right. So when you shop at the grocery store, and a lot of our food in Hawaii is imported from the mainland, that food that's grown in, say, California, that's not affected by international tariffs, right? So tariffs are going to have an impact on prices and on the things that people buy, but it's not really clear whether Hawaii consumers have any more international imported goods than other states. Hawaii actually imports less than other states, and that's because about half of imports are materials and equipment, and that's used in manufacturing in the US and elsewhere, right? And Hawaii doesn't have a lot of manufacturing because of our isolation and the transport costs that would be involved with manufacturing. And so actually that means Hawaii imports less than other states. So directly speaking, Hawaii's kind of less exposed to international tariffs than other places. The effect on Hawaii is really this secondary impact, that when there's that slowdown in the economy in the US, and if there's a slowdown in international travel because they don't want to visit the US right now, that compounds the effect on Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And even so, I mean, that's not to say that there aren't small businesses here that do import a lot of their material or products or outsource some of that labor. We've talked to a number of small businesses here, and they don't necessarily see a way out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. The effect of tariff is going to be very uneven depending on where you're buying your goods from or buying your inputs to your business from. And some businesses are going to be very dependent on imports, and they'll be facing massive increases in costs. And if it persists for a long time, that will put some businesses out of business. So businesses have sort of been responding to this by, say, importing ahead of time, right? And so actually one of the things we saw in the latest quarter was a decrease in US GDP overall. And this was blamed on imports, but it's really that this was businesses or even consumers stockpiling ahead of time. They were buying those imported goods instead of buying domestic goods. And that meant that domestic production within the US declined a little bit.
I think what a lot of people might want to know at the end of the day is just how this forecast will show up in their everyday life. Like, as they go about their day, how are they going to feel what a slight recession feels like?
Sure. So for a lot of people, if you're in a secure job and everything you might not be affected much at all. Things just continue on. But for other people where their work is a bit more insecure, they might be holding back on spending right now. And that holding back flows through then to those people in more secure positions as well. So you'll feel that business is not pumping quite as much as perhaps it was before. But for a lot of people, they won't be affected. It'll be the people that are in less secure jobs or where their income is directly dependent on sales and things like that. Those are the people who are really going to feel it a bit more. The other thing that's quite common during recessions is people tend to go back to school and get more skills, right? So if they don't have a job right now, they might enroll in a course to learn some more skills to help them get another job.
That's interesting. Did you look at all to see whether these tariffs might increase local manufacturing, or was that at all part of the prediction?
It wouldn't necessarily help much with manufacturing in Hawaii, but potentially across the US, it will have some effect that manufacturers would have to produce some stuff locally rather than internationally. But that also still has this chilling effect, because if it was the reason they're importing is because they make money from importing it, right? It's cheaper for them to import it and sell that product, and they make more profit from doing that than they do from producing it themselves. And so if they're going to start having to produce it themselves or source from domestic suppliers, they're going to face higher costs from doing that. And that's why they're choosing not to do that initially, right? And so those higher costs still have the same chilling effect on investment and on consumer confidence and consumer spending, right? So that's certainly accounted for in that slowdown. The effect of tariffs is not just the amount that you pay for the tariffs. It's also the amount that you pay for, say, other goods. and how businesses have to change their supply chains, right? If they were previously importing, they now are looking for domestic suppliers who are more expensive. And then also changing that supply chain comes with some cost as well. So all of those costs flow through to business investment and consumer prices and just a general slowdown in economic activity.
Is there anything else that you want to add or anything you feel like top line takeaways for listeners?
I mean, the main takeaways are about tourism softening. In the near term, there's a softening of international tourists because of the tariffs and because of the geopolitical environment. Slightly longer term, as the U.S. economy starts to slow, then there'll be a further reduction in U.S. visitors, right? And that is the main driver of our slowdown in Hawaii. I think the point I really want to point forward, though, is about Hawaii's long-run growth rate. So Hawaii's long-run growth rate is relatively low, and it's lower than the U.S. And so that means there's this widening gap between Hawaii and the rest of the U.S. And that's the case anyway, regardless of these tariffs. The tariffs push us into negative territory, but that long-run, low productivity growth, that's a general problem for the Hawaii economy that we need to really think about. How do we address that low productivity growth?
That was UHERO researcher Stephen Bond-Smith talking to HBR's Maddie Bender. We reached out to Bond-Smith this morning after news broke that the U.S. and China have agreed to temporarily suspend tariffs for 90 days. He said the deal announced with China today doesn't change the outlook. Tariffs are still much higher than just a few months ago, and there is significant uncertainty about what tariff rates will be in the future. We'll have a link to the UHERO forecast on our website after the show.
China is now trying to save itself, trying to save its economy by ramping up exports to the rest of the world. And that has real consequences for any other country with a manufacturing sector, whether it's Brazil or Mexico or Germany or Japan or South Korea or the United States.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
If you've got fresh ideas on how HPR can best serve our islands, apply to join our Community Advisory Board. We're looking for people from all islands. The feedback from our volunteer board helps us shape our programming and events. Apply by May 16th at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB.
Senate and House leaders are weighing details of a special session amid talk of a possible recession. We spoke with Senate President Ron Kochi and House Speaker Nadine Nakamura on Friday as the latest UHERO economic forecast was released. Nakamura says it's not surprising a mild recession seems inevitable.
Because of the federal policies cutting funding, it's impacting our employment base for federal employees. It's cutting resources to critical programs without any regard to the impacts on our environment, on our community, on our travel to Hawaii, tariffs that are going to impact the cost of living in Hawaii. All of these things, it's because of federal leadership that at the executive and congressional level that is not looking out for the residents of our country and the state of Hawaii. We definitely anticipated these impacts, and we are planning ahead with a special session sometime this year once we get a better picture of the specific impacts to Hawaii's state budget.
Do you have any preferences doing session earlier versus later in the year?
Well, I think that unfortunately for us, all of the decisions would be driven by what Washington does, so we're really not in control of the timeline. Once the action or inaction occurs, then we would need to take the assessment and determine what would be necessary. Would it be limited to the budget only, or would some of the cuts require us to look at some other policy changes, and only after taking that assessment would a determination be made as to when to come in. And just to echo what the speaker said, what is frustrating is that it was not something that was well thought out in what they started doing. This morning's news talked about 23,000 people with the Internal Revenue Service who took the buyout, and they were supposed to be done with work at the end of last month and paid through September as the incentive to take the buyout. But they cannot process all of the paperwork to, do the function of the IRS, which is essentially collect income tax to help the government run. And so now they are all told they'll have to work to July 1st to get paid. And they didn't do a simple calculation of how many employees would be required to do that job. And some of the other departments, after the layoffs, they were immediately calling people back because they then realized the important work that the people they laid off were doing and how critical it was to have them in those jobs doing the work.
I know that there was some controversy toward the end of the session about the assault ban bill, and that died. Do you think there's a chance that that would be resurrected in a special session?
There is an opportunity for anything to be considered if we have consensus. But the other thing that becomes challenging when we get outside of dealing with the shortfalls that are going to be a result of the federal action is that there are numerous legislators that were working really hard and had some bills that didn't pass that would all be lining up to say mine is really important and it should be considered. And at some point, we need to make sure we can get in and do the most important thing, which is get our budget in balance and then hopefully, have that path that is going to deliver the services and the financial support that our residents so badly will need.
You know, we're looking at dates at the end of August, the end of September, and then the week before Thanksgiving, as three possible five-day blocks where we've asked our members to set aside if and when we need to return to a special session. And at this point, the priority will be the budget. It is a limited time. It requires members to be on the same page because there's not any room in the five-day block for amendments.
Senator Cochi, is there anything you want to say to explain your tiebreaker vote on that assault bill?
Well, representing Kauai, we have a large fishing and hunting community. I think Senator San Buenaventura and Senator DeCoit explained quite well about how legal law-abiding citizens today could wind up becoming felons overnight, and how do we find a way to ensure that responsible gun owners, law-abiding, and in the case of Kauai specifically, a lot of them are hunting or fishing to put food on their table because of the financial limitations. At this point, we would like to see something where we don't make criminals out of our people. I think there was universal support for the 50 caliber ban, and then all of a sudden, this went way beyond that.
I guess it remains to be seen whether that is a bill that will come up if you do go into special session. Speaker, I know that the big news this week is the shakeup over on the House, the Finance, the Money Committee. What can you tell us about what prompted that?
There were concerns raised, and, at the end of the day, we opted to go with new leadership, and we appreciate the hard work that went into developing our budget, and we are indebted to Representative Kyle Yamashita for all the work that he's done as finance chair, and it was just a matter of moving in a new direction.
With the uncertainty with the federal budget with Congress, you have Chris Todd stepping in to Yamashita's position. Do you think he's up for the challenge?
I'm very confident that he will do a great job as finance chair. Over the past year, Chris has been part of the leadership team, and in through the work he has done for me as speaker, behind the scenes, analyzing different issues for me, I am very confident that he will do an excellent job.
I don't know. Should we expect any additional changes in the leadership lineup to come? What's your sense?
You know, because Representative Todd will leave as majority caucus leader, there will be a trickle down effect. And so we are working on the pieces that need to be put together to fill the pukas.
Senator, I know that there was some criticism about bills that were sent to the money committees, Ways and Means and Finance, that ultimately didn't make it through at the end. Do you have any concerns about that?
Well, I can just speak to Senator De La Cruz. He was efficient in getting out the message as to which bills that there was money for. You know, sometimes chairs get frustrated at the end and wonder what happened, but with the limitation of funding this year and an eye on having to come back, some of the bills simply died because we ran out of money that we were going to allocate. And that's always part of the process.
Well, I think there were some bills that didn't have any money attachment and yet didn't make it out. I think the clean government bills about prohibiting donations from contractors, we were hearing that that was a concern. Do you think anything will change going forward?
You know, we'll see. I know we had submitted a draft that was criticized as well, that, they felt was not as stringent enough. For me, I would have preferred that we could have passed at least that. Then we had something on the books that can be amended in the future. So I'm hopeful that some form of 371 will pass next year.
Anything else you want to underscore just on the Senate side and what you were able to get agreement on?
Senator Keoho Kalole, Representative Matayoshi did great work and worked hard in the interim with the private sector and the administration on the insurance stabilization. That continues to be a work in progress, but we do have a framework of hopefully trying to ensure that we have insurance available in the marketplace for, homeowners here. That was critically important. We had House Bill 701 or 702. Senator San Buenaventura and Representative Takayama worked diligently to try to make sure that we can keep a control on the price of prescription drugs. The speaker can talk in much better length and detail, but there was significant funding for affordable housing again and some reforms, and I appreciate all of the efforts of Senator Chang. I'm, thrilled with part of the product that came out because Representative Evslin is the representative district that I live in back on Kauai. And so the two of them did really great work. And then, really not touted, but I brought up that day was all of the controversy for about a year in trying to get the cultural and Hawaiian practitioner position on the State Water Commission filled. Senator Inouye was very strong and unwavering in what she thought it would take as far as the kind of individual and qualifications. And when Hannah Springer finally came through, she was unanimously approved by the Senate. And I think that's significant because the water issues are so important for any of our planning going forward.
And Speaker, anything you want to underscore?
I want to give a shout out to Rep. Luke Evslin and Rep. Lisa Martin for their work on the affordable housing bills. A whole slew of them passed. $370 million in rental housing revolving funds, Tier 1 and Tier 2, which means we get to build more housing for working families in Hawaii, which I'm very excited to see. We also passed the Kauhale Bill, Governor's Big Initiative, that includes Ohana Zone funding that will continue the work to build more housing so that the homeless have a place to go. We're also excited that Rep. Kahaloa worked on the Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity Bill that creates this new department, that renames the department and provides significant funding for staff and resources to address invasive species in Hawaii. Rep. Matayoshi worked on firework bills, working very closely with the prosecutor's office and the attorney general's office to create a lot more mechanisms for enforcement using drones, extending the work of the Illegal Fireworks Task Force, doing sting operations, creating a citation system to really look at the need for enforcement of our firework laws. Big shout out to Rep. Parnas for the work with the judiciary's budget, strengthening the work of our judiciary, which is critically important at this point in time, and in giving resources to make a women's court and outreach court permanent in some of the districts. And then working very closely with the governor on the TAT bill increase, a moderate increase that will allow us to work on the impacts of climate change on Hawaii's environment and economy. So I'm really excited about that bill, and then working real closely with the lieutenant governor on expansion to the preschool initiative to get to universal preschool. We added 103 new positions and expanded the preschool open doors program to include two-year-olds. A lot of good things that came out of this session. So I'm really proud of what we were able to accomplish by working with the Senate, by working with the administration to really meet the needs of the residents of the state of Hawaii.
That was House Speaker Nadine Nakamura and Senate President Ron Kochi, two influential Kauai lawmakers. We should note that Kochi says he is up for re-election but has not yet made a decision on whether he will run. He did acknowledge that a third Kauai lawmaker, Mayor Derek Kawakami, who is term limited, announced his intention to raise money to run for the Garden Isles Senate seat with his blessing. Kawakami has made no secret that he has aspirations for higher office and under campaign spending laws, could consider a run for lieutenant governor or governor.
Pope Leo XIV has already made history as the first American to lead the Catholic Church, but he also has deep roots in Peru, where he has spent decades of his life and ministry. We visit the city of Chiclayu to hear how Leo's tenure as bishop has impacted Catholic life there. That story and the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NereidHawaii.com.
Honolulu attorneys Becky Gardner and Will Tungal are pointing out that judges of Filipino ancestry are underrepresented on the bench. Gardner is the head of the Hawaii Filipino Lawyers Association and is licensed both here and in New York. She recently wrote an opinion piece for the Honolulu Star Advertiser. We spoke with the two of them on Friday about why they think Hawaii needs more Filipino judges.
We have not had adequate representation of judges of Filipino ancestry since the inception of the judiciary. Currently, the Filipino population of Hawaii is close to 25%, a quarter of a population. But right now, we have less than 10% representation of judges of Filipino ancestry. And this, you know, is a mix. It doesn't have to be 100% Filipino, but still with that, it's less than 10%. And particularly problematic is there's zero representation at the appellate level. And so not since the retirement of Justice Acoba back in 2014, I believe it was, there has been no judge of Philippine ancestry at the appellate level.
And we'll, you know, jump in here because it's not for lack of nominations.
Just to give you a background, back in 1990, we had three judges appointed to the district court and circuit court. And the Hawaii Filipino Lawyers Association was so happy about that, that we had a, you know, a banquet to basically honor them. And that was Judge Acoba, Judge Ibarra from the Big Island, and Judge Florendo in the district court in Kona. And that was back in 1990. So they were the only three full-time judges. And we also honored a retired federal judge, Alfred Loretta, originally from Kauai and the first Filipino-American appointed to a federal district court in the Northern Marianas. So that was in 1990. So today, with 78 full-time judges from district all the way to the appellate court, Supreme Court, we only had six Filipino judges. And the recent appointment of Maria Penn, I guess that makes it seven. So approximately about 7% of the judiciary. So you can see, you know, yeah, we went from three to seven with the recent appointment, but still very much underrepresented. And as Becky pointed out, the appellate court is kind of important. We haven't had representation in the ICA for more than 10 years because Justice Acoba, who used to be in the ICA initially, moved up to Supreme Court, but since then they haven't appointed any Filipino in the ICA. And of course, in the Supreme Court, at one time people were saying, what are you complaining about? You got both Mario Ramil and Justice Acoba there. You got two out of five.
Yeah, very fine justices.
Yeah, but then, Mario Ramil served, a 10-year term and then retired. And Justice Acoba retired more than 10 years ago. So pretty much we've been quiet about this until the most recent one, because now the Judicial Selection Commission, I think they're starting to see the problem, and they had Filipinos on the list. Imagine this, you got eight appointments submitted, but only one was appointed.
I think what we're seeing in terms of a pattern, as the president of the Hawaii Filipino Lawyers Association, we've got bench of our membership is 80 attorneys, which is a pretty sizable amount. So we're getting into law school. We're passing the bar. We're amongst the bar. We're representing people. We're making the grade, so to say, but we're not getting appointed. And this is very important because we look at judges perhaps or becoming a judge as a mark of, the merit and, all the accolades that you get to come to that position. But the role of a judge is to dispense justice and look at controversies and cases of the public. And their perspective should reflect the experiences of the public, especially when you get up to the appellate levels, because that's what makes precedent. And so we're getting into law school, passing the bar, and working hard getting there, but there's something that's keeping us from getting appointed. And, no one's pointing fingers. Perhaps it's just lack of awareness, but that's why we're here today, is just to press this issue. Like, look, what's going on? How come we're not getting appointed? We certainly have the chops.
Well, it's an interesting conversation to have just because the climate that we're under now, with DEI, right? Diversity, mm-hmm. Equity, and Inclusion. And locally, we've just had a panel of judges sworn in, which included the first Tongan judge. So how do you see this?
So, I'm glad you brought that up, Catherine. So 2 points. First, with regards to the DEI and whatnot, we believe that it's important that the bench reflect the community, not just the bar, because the bar is not the only one paying for the judge's salary. It should reflect the community of the whole state. Secondly, we're happy for Judge Ongan, because the Polynesian community, Tongan and the Samoan, they do deserve a representation. And I saw the testimony during his confirmation hearing. It was beautiful. They were very proud that finally someone who's qualified was being appointed. And the second point I wanted to make with regards to the diversity, and I know this administration, I shall not name him, looked down upon it, but our own Chief Justice, Justice Rechtenwald, support diversity. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to read an exact quote so that you'll understand. He himself, Justice Rechtenwald, said, "Our goal is to maintain a judiciary that has the most qualified judges and staff who reflect the community they serve. This fosters an environment where persons from all backgrounds know their voices will be heard and their disputes will be resolved fairly." And I couldn't agree more. But our concern is, even with the CJ, he's not following what he's saying. Based on the, I believe, 18 years that he's been CJ. He has made some Filipino appointments, but I can count it on one hand.
Yeah, as to this, notion of DEI and all the pushback for it. I mean, Hawaii's different. The minority is the majority here. And maybe the DEI concerns may have some credence when you're trying to rise to CEO of a company or, you know, partner of a law firm or something like that. But that's private sphere. This is matters relating to everyday people, divorces, crimes, you know, business. This is how we operate. This is just the engine of society here. And when there's conflict, who's evaluating the arguments? And we do want that diversity of perspectives dispensing with these decisions. And they need to be culturally informed. Some of the issues that the Filipino community and, you know, the Micronesians and multiple communities in Hawaii is immigration. We know that's huge right now. Domestic violence, educational matters, and perhaps something that Filipinos are very acutely aware of is language access and the way it connects with culture and, you know, sense of like deference and family and all the rest of it. So, you know, that when there's a Filipino judge, I've clerked for Filipino judges, and they see their parties, if they're Filipino, in a much different light. You know, they may be asking more follow-up questions because they're like, oh, that seems like a culturally appropriate response. Maybe they're afraid of stepping up to authority or sort of thing. So they may ask additional questions to get to the true root of a matter.
Yeah, they have greater sensitivity maybe.
Exactly.
This conversation reminds me of a time when we had the same issues come up in the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. Because there were so few Filipino teachers that were getting hired. It was predominantly, I think, Japanese at the time. And there was a greater scrutiny on, let's look at the pool of applicants. How many have applied and why aren't they getting placed as teachers? And then we saw just the other day where the teachers with the visas to come here and teach in our schools were caught up in this ICE raid.
Yeah, and I think it reflects some of the history of Filipinos in Hawaii. You know, we've been the backbone of the labor market. You know, they're being outsourced for the teaching, for healthcare, for hospitality, for plantation work. So why are we hitting this ceiling when it comes to these elite decision-making roles?
Are there additional vacancies coming up that need to be filled?
Yeah, we expect that there will be immediately one in the ICA because Judge Nakasone, who sits in the ICA, has just been appointed to be the chief judge. So that would leave one vacancy. And from what I understand from her testimony, there's also one vacant that has not been filled. So there'd be two vacancies that the governor can appoint. With the Supreme Court, that's going to be open up because the CJ will reach the mandatory age of 70 this year. So depending on whether someone from within the Supreme Court applies and get elevated, there's going to be at least one vacancy there. In the Circuit Court, there may be because those who are close to the retirement age, and I'm not sure if anyone is close to 70, there may be one or two, but they're mostly, from what I gather, mostly younger ones. Now, the lower courts, they're kind of important because, as Becky points out, that's where the public usually go. Sometimes they're referred to as the People's Court, the Family Court, and the District Court. The District Court, they have 14 District Court judges. There's no Filipino so far. In the Family Court, a little better now because we have Judge Pan, and then there's also Judge Montalbano, who's part Filipino. He was appointed a couple of years ago. In the Circuit Court, we have 14 judges, and that's Oahu, where, you know, we have the largest population. There's two female Filipina, Judge Remigio and Judge Molinao. Governor Green, and I do give him credit, he's appointed a lot of females, and he mentions it in his press release. But then you got to look into more than that.
Yeah, the point I really want to stress as well is these are matters of the parties, right? Or maybe in criminal court, which ethnic groups or what parts of our community are most likely in court? Who's experiencing domestic violence? Who's experiencing divorce? Who's perpetrating crimes? Maybe that's a reflection of some stressors on the community. And, you know, rather than blaming victims who end up perpetuating crimes, you know, maybe a judge who understands their circumstances can dispense with some sort of sentencing or, you know, judgment that's going to help provide therapeutic justice, restorative justice. It takes an understanding of what's happening at the ground level, and maybe not only those who've been cherry-picked and have attended the highest educational institutions and the best law schools or whatnot, or know the right people. I mean, we need people who know all the people.
Well, thank you both for coming in and speaking out.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what happens with the next announcement of vacancies. And our organization is also doing our work to help prepare other Filipino attorneys to apply for the judgeships.
We've been hearing from Honolulu attorneys Becky Gardner and Will Tungal about their advocacy for more Filipino judges on the bench, particularly at the appellate level.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
As the U.S. military faces a recruiting crisis, it needs more qualified women than ever. So why is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth canceling a program supporting them?
Whether you think it's woke or not is irrelevant. Our strategic environment is much more difficult. And so cutting off pathways for recruiting and retaining forces, it doesn't make sense to me.
That's coming up Monday on Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
The unexpected selection of Pope Leo XIV from the heartland of America will be celebrated tonight by Bishop Larry Silva. He will lead Mass at the Co-Cathedral of St. Teresa of the Child Jesus in Kalihi. Just last week, a Mass was held in that same cathedral to honor the late Pope Francis, who died the day after Easter. On Friday, we reached out to longtime religion reporter Mary Adamski. For 50 years, she worked at the Honolulu Star Bulletin, and for the last decade there, she covered religion. She currently writes a column for the Hawaii Catholic Herald called View from the Pew, the Take of the Church from Its Members. We talked to her Friday afternoon from her parish church.
Well, I love the bells as we sit here in St. Patrick's Church. What can you tell us about our new pope? I mean, the fact that he's the first American pope is amazing.
It makes me feel hopeful about America and also the church. And I like it, the perspective. This man wasn't just always in America, but he was in South America and Peru for years. He's a missionary, kind of pastoral person, but his roots are in the Midwest, which means a lot to me because I am from Wisconsin. And like people in Hawaii who have an idea that we understand spirit of aloha here like no one else does. That's how you feel in the Midwest, that we are more common folk, calmer with each other, working class people who have a respect for each other. So I have this Midwesterner pride in the new pope because he's from Chicago and he's a Cubs fan. My dad was a Cubs fan. I grew up with the endless drone of Cubs games on the radio, and my dad you had to be quiet when he's listening to it. So it's like, first thing when I saw that, I was talking to my father, and who is in heaven now? Did you get that? The Pope is a Cubs fan. makes everybody laugh in my. So I have been in this chain with family and friends, everybody chiming in about the new Pope Leo. I like things that are being said about him. I wrote down yesterday when I listened to Father James Martin, who is a Jesuit. He's the editor of America Magazine, which is a pretty important Catholic magazine. And he listed all these great traits that the new Pope has. He's a good listener. He's patient. He's very confident in himself. He's pastoral rather than a bureaucrat. I love all that.
There are some who wonder what the climate and politics of the world may have had in selecting this pope. You know, I know President Donald Trump, I think, tweeted out a image of him as pope. And so, yes, people are wondering about that.
That was so stupid. I believe Pope Francis brought this man into the as a cardinal. He also brought Pope Leo into Department of the Vatican, which does the vetting and, you know, sorting out who will be elevated to bishop throughout the world. He brought him in to have some administrative mileage. I really believe that he was on Francis's short list for sure of people with perspective of inclusion and be more concerned about what little individual Catholics are suffering through rather than be voice of the world. I don't expect him to be as out there as Francis was. Francis welcoming and saying, who am I to judge when the subject of gay people being even allowed in the church anymore and they're not shunned or whatever, but to have the blessing of their unions and such. Those are hot issues. And a lot of conservative Catholics, it raises the hair on their, they do not like some of those things that Francis did. I love that Francis brought women into the discussions. One of the areas was the Department of Choosing Bishops. There are three or four women who are on that advisory committee who have a voice in what they see as things a bishop should. That's a big step in the Catholic Church.
So you're really hopeful with Pope Leo.
I thought he was a very modest person up in the balcony. He wasn't big smile waving. I loved it when he switched from speaking Italian to Spanish. And there was a big roar from the crowd. You know, a whole lot of the world is Spanish speaking. That's what is one of his huge traits, which not every American clergyman would have. He's got several languages, Italian and Spanish and Latin, can you believe? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, you know, hearing the news stories about his roots, his Creole roots. He's part Italian, part French. So it's just fascinating. But I think people just never really imagined the day when there would be an American pope.
That's what I would have said 3 days ago, that no, it won't be an American. I was kind of happy with a Filipino cardinal, as probably I have good feelings about that one.
Well, my Italian friend said she was hoping for Pizzaballa because she just loved that name, the Italian,
Italian
cardinal.
Right. Well, it's, you know, from a New World perspective, the Italians were the popes for centuries. It belonged to them almost. And then it was a European. So it's about time that the universal church that we talk about starts being in universally led church, South American, just did his thing. North American's going to have his time. You know, that's who we're supposed to be, is Christ throughout the world and not just owned by Rome. I think he probably has a good chance of interfaith outreach. The fact that he picked the name Leo, the fact the last Pope Leo was at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, and he's considered the founder of the whole social justice attitude of the church now, that it's important that we take care of working people. It is okay for working people to be paid enough and not be exploited, and okay to be in a union. And Pope Leo XIII is an iconic pastor and pope that people still remember. So when he picked that name, that wasn't by chance, I'm quite sure.
What do you think this is going to mean to Catholics in America and Catholics here in Hawaii?
I think it's a hope thing for everybody, that if we can feel more and more we're important in the bigger picture. I hope everything like this brings people back. So many people drift away and decided I'll go on Easter, I'll go on Christmas, I don't go to Mass every week. It's young members in my family are going through that. It's interesting to be a Christian these days. Why don't you at least be a volunteer, if not attending every service? The more he does that's human and being a listener, being a caring pastor kind of person, is going to help bring people maybe back to the church. The other element of hope that I have, and I wrote about a couple months ago, was that Pope Francis named a new Archbishop of Washington, D.C., just in time for the new president. And he's a former bishop in San Diego at the boundary, at the border, and he's one of the many Catholic clergy of other religions, too, who push back at the idea of treating immigrants and people desperate to get into our country as if they're all evil and inhuman treatment of them. So I love that new Bishop McElroy in Washington. And I also included a little bit about the new Episcopal bishop, who's a woman, who sat and looked the president in the eye at the inaugural service in the National Cathedral and talked about not right to treat immigrants and refugees as less than human.
And yes, and she talked about mercy, having mercy.
Yes, mercy. Oh, yes. So I like, those things are issues of hope for me as a voice we should be. The Pope's going to be that voice, and our bishops everywhere also should be.
I think, though, Catholics, you know, with the loss of Pope Francis, feel sad because he was a great leader. What a fine example he set.
I think you saw that personally if you went in church after he died. People were here not just at a time of a Mass service, but just coming in here just to say a prayer or to mourn him. Francis was a real person. It wasn't just a thing you read about in the paper. You really felt like you knew him.
He really lived his faith.
He's washing the feet of prisoners in a prison. He visited the prison a couple days before Easter. He was okay to be out there in the gritty part of the world, not just in the White House and the palace and whatever. We can't measure those two men and expect Pope Leo to do everything the way Francis did it. He has a different dignity, and so I wouldn't be upset with him moving into the Papal Palace instead of Francis living in a humble hotel that he did. I just hope he's not so shy or humble that he has layers of other people speaking for him, which has happened in the past. Father James Martin, that I mentioned, he went through this whole list of all the wonderful things a person could be. It was like he's open, he's humble, he's modest, he's decisive, he's understanding. It's like a list of what you wish you were and what you wish anybody you had to deal with would be.
That was Mary Adamski, longtime journalist and former religion reporter for the Honolulu Star Bulletin and now columnist for the Catholic Hawaii Herald, talking about the selection of the first pope from the U.S. And we should note, when we talked to Adamski last week, that reports were just coming out that Pope Leo's brother was telling media that his brother was actually a Chicago White Sox fan. We hope the Cubs will find it in their hearts to forgive him. The diocese will hold a 6 o'clock Mass tonight at the Co-Cathedral of St. Teresa's on North School Street. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we hope to hear from Bishop Larry Silva about Pope Leo XIV. What do you think about America's first pope? Call our talkback line, record something at 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.